Cities produce more than 60% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Big cities get a lot of attention, but most household emissions in the U.S. actually come from communities outside urban cores, making them critical players in climate mitigation and climate justice. City Climate Corner explores how these small and mid-sized cities are tackling climate change and moving toward an equitable and sustainable future. I'm Abby Finnis.
And I'm Larry Kraft. We're co-hosts for City Climate Corner.
Hey, Larry.
Hey, Abby.
So we're at the tail end of COP26. Have you been following it?
Yes, I have been. You?
A little bit here and there. I saw, and we posted, a really good kind of succinct thread of what COP26 even is.
What does COP stand for, by the way?
So that is Conference of Parties. And that's when, you know, everybody gets together and talks about climate change across the world. And I would encourage you to check out the thread and check out our Twitter. Basically, nations get together every year and talk about climate change. And since the Paris Agreement, nations have designated that every 5 years they come together with their nationally determined contributions. So what their plan is to meet the Paris Accord, which is to try to hold warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And so they did that and they came. And I think that together their plans will stop warming to about 2.7 or 2.8 degrees centigrade, which is not good. So there's a lot of work to be done. And then there's reducing those contributions, those greenhouse gas emissions. And there's also, how do we help the countries that are getting hit the hardest and have the least amount of resources and have contributed the least to climate change? So all of those conversations are happening now. And I don't know that it's been a super optimistic couple of weeks.
Yeah, I follow it. And if you take a big step back, there is progress, but just not enough. It's my belief that at some point in this journey we're on, and I am an optimist, that things will start happening faster than expected on the good side. But we're obviously not there yet.
We need to get to the faster.
Yeah, we do.
It continues to underscore how critical local level action is. And I love the coverage that Ithaca, New York has been getting around its plan to decarbonize all of its buildings. And I think that that's part of that. Get to the faster. How do we speed this up? What are the pieces that we put into place to really ramp that up? I hope that that will be really successful and that we can turn that into some kind of a turnkey solution for cities to pursue and get that federal boost of funding to support it.
By the way, Ithaca sounds familiar to me. Didn't we do an episode on that?
Yeah, a couple episodes back. Yeah, check it out. Check out Ithaca, New York.
But what are we talking about in this episode?
We're talking to Cooper Martin from the National League of Cities. And in the last decade or so, the National League of Cities has really ramped up its tools and resources that are available to cities to tackle climate change. And so we're going to talk to him about what the league has been up to for both mitigation and some resilience measures.
From my own personal experience, when I joined City Council a couple of years ago, I got to go to the last in-person training that the National League of Cities held. And as a new council member, I found it incredibly helpful to on a variety of fronts to take advantage of what other people have already learned in an organized fashion.
Yeah, they've got a lot of good stuff and it keeps getting better. So it's a really good resource for folks to check out. And now you get to listen to Cooper.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Today, we are speaking with Cooper Martin of the National League of Cities. Welcome, Cooper. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
As you said, I'm Cooper. I am the Director of Sustainability and City Solutions at the National League of Cities, based in Washington, D.C., where I've been working for a little over 7 years supporting local sustainability efforts.
I imagine that most city staff and elected officials tend to be familiar with the National League of Cities, but residents are not. Can you give us maybe a little background on the league and what it does for municipalities across the country?
Of course. National League of Cities is the oldest and largest organization in the country representing local governments. We're a membership association. So just as the Bar Association works with lawyers or the American Medical Association work with doctors, we work with mayors and council members around the country on leadership development, research, training, executive education, to make sure that they are as effective as possible in representing their constituents, and that they have all the information from cities around the country on best practices that can help make their communities more thriving, stronger places to be.
Hey, how did you wind up working for the National League of Cities?
Yeah, I actually started my career with another membership association, the American Institute of Architects. And I had several jobs there, working in government and community relations, doing research, doing technical assistance on sustainable design, transportation policy, small business access to credit. A lot of architects are small business people. After working there for several years, the opportunity to run a sustainability and resilience program at NLC came up. I applied for it. I knew at the time who the organization was. I have a lot of colleagues who had worked across the different organizations. Certainly no disrespect to architects and everything that they do. It was a fantastic organization, but I like to say I still do the same work, but with a more powerful membership base of local elected officials who can implement policies and pursue livability, climate resilience, climate action at the local level.
The League offers a wealth of assistance across a broad range of topics. And, you know, today, of course, on City Climate Corner, we want to focus a bit on the sustainability resources that are available. I believe there's a program called the City Solution Group. Is that the right title? And can you give an overview of that?
You hit it right on the head. NLC does a lot of different things on behalf of cities. First and foremost, we are an advocacy organization. We're the voice for cities in Washington. We advocate for policy to benefit cities, to get more resources directly into the hands of local government so that they can implement them where they're closest to their residents. And then I work in the Center for City Solutions, which covers a wide array of functions that are sort of core to what cities do: financial development, economic development, housing. I run our sustainability program. We do a lot on urban innovation and civic tech, civic data, and a range of other issues. So the Center for City Solutions does research, technical assistance, and then our NLC University is also housed here. So when we do research, we try to turn that into training opportunities, as I mentioned, skill building for local elected officials so that they can be the most effective executives that they can. And then I've run our sustainability and climate programs, as I mentioned, for the last several years. Our mission within the Center for City Solutions is to support, inform, and celebrate city-led sustainability efforts. And that's really important for not just my program, but everything that we do at NLC, is that it's informed by and led by our members at the local level.
You know, a lot of cities are looking at the American Rescue Plan and looking at how they can use some of the funding for different sustainability initiatives. And I've gone to the League's website to seek guidance on, you know, how that funding can be spent. Is that something that you help cities with? And are they able to use that for different climate initiatives?
Absolutely. It's definitely something we've been helping with cities with. It's something that we continue to get more specific about. When the ARPA dollars first came, the American Rescue Plan dollars first came to cities, a lot of time was spent with the Treasury guidance, just trying to parse out what the guidance says, what is eligible for cities to spend their money on. This was the first time in the history of our country that the federal government has provided dollars funding directly to local governments. So every city in the country has an allocation that they're assigned basically based on the population in order to get money right into the hands of local government, as I mentioned. And this, I think, was really an important lesson that we took away from the last recovery package, where local government austerity programs, cuts to local government during the Great Recession, weren't made whole in the recovery plans that came out 10 years ago. And that really was a drag on our economy. It was a drag on local services. And learning that lesson this time, we did provide resources directly to local governments. And we've spent the last several months going over the guidance, as I mentioned. And it's really very flexible. Now that we have spent a little bit of time going over what is eligible, which is pretty wide ranging, we're turning to provide some guidance and recommendations on sort of the highest and best use of those funds. Not just what could you use your money for, but what should you use your money for? And there are a whole lot of opportunities for sustainability and climate action. First and foremost, around water, maintenance programs, getting lead pipes out of homes, and upgrading that water infrastructure is specifically called out in the recovery package as an eligible use. Green infrastructure, treating stormwater locally and not having it run as pollutants and sewer overflows into our streams and rivers and lakes is another specific area that's called out in the guidance. But then there's some really interesting stuff that gets a little bit more creative. And the ARPA apportionments are eligible for things such as economic resilience. It's also eligible for things like public health. And there you can look at a whole range of disaster mitigation efforts. You could look at air quality improvements at the local level as providing for public health. And so as cities start to spend these dollars over the next several years, and they don't have to be spent until at least 2025, they can really start to get a little bit more creative about how they choose to allocate those funds. Because right now we know that they're just trying to, you know, rebuild their rainy day funds, plug revenue gaps that we saw in 2020. But over the next couple of years, once that 1 year of crisis really starts to get a little bit more behind us, and the health crisis starts to hopefully start recovering more rapidly than it has, that's when we are starting to probably provide more recommendations about how cities can use these funds a little bit more creatively for sustainability.
Yeah, it's been incredibly useful to me, and I really appreciate those resources. I'm not sure that cities necessarily always know that that's there, or, you know, that the funding or different things apply to them or how they can use it. And so that's really useful. And I encourage anybody listening to jump on the League's website and check it out. It's really good and laid out really well. So I appreciate that. What are some of the other tools that your group has available for cities?
We do a lot of our work in partnership. I think one of the real values that NLC brings is not just the technical expertise and the issue area or subject matter expertise that we have internally, but because we do so many different things and we have access to so many different cities, we work with a whole array of partner organizations, coalition partners. A couple of the things that we really offer our members, the first is our own research, which is often informed by those partnerships. And right now, for instance, I'm working on, and actually by the time you as a listener are hearing this, you'll be able to access our latest solid waste recycling and circular economy report. And that's being done in partnership with an organization called ReLoop Partners. For several years, we've been part of a coalition called the Smart Surfaces Coalition. And there we connect our members with the latest cost-benefit analyses on what it means to move away from dark, impervious surfaces, asphalt parking lots, black roofs, and things like that, and start deploying more sustainable surfaces. We call them smart surfaces, but we're talking about tree canopy improvements, bioswales, and green infrastructure, rooftop solar, green roofs, basically anything to lighten the surfaces of a city, and really doing detailed analysis of the cost and benefits that can accrue to a city from that. That coalition just released a report 2 weeks ago on the city of Stockton. They've also done in-depth reports in Baltimore, DC, El Paso, Philadelphia. So that's another good resource that you can definitely find on our website. And then we do a lot of direct technical assistance. One of the programs that we have run for the last 5 years is a Department of Energy program called SoulSmart. And it's a rating system. It's also free technical assistance. And so we'll go into a city and we'll do an analysis of your permitting, zoning, building codes, application processes, and see how that stacks up against known national best practices in solar. We'll give you an initial rating, gold, silver, bronze, show you how many points you've scored. But then it identifies easy opportunities to improve that solar permitting process or that solar zoning process, get maybe a higher designation in the SolSmart program. And so we've worked with over 400 cities and counties now to reduce the cost of solar, make it faster, quicker, easier for residents to go solar. And the last program I'll mention, which has also been going for about 5 years, is Leadership in Community Resilience. And I know we'll probably dig in a little bit to that, but it's been a grant program where we take in applications, we award cities $10,000, as well as a year of ongoing support and technical assistance. And that's a much more customized process where we'll identify partners based on the city's stated needs, based on their priorities for the year, and try to enable them to spend those grant proceeds as effectively as possible.
Well, that's a great segue. My question was going to be to give us some background on that program, but you anticipated and did that, which is great. But let's dig into that a little more. Is there a certain type of city you're looking for in that program? Is it cities of all sizes? And how does one get involved in that?
I think it's useful to go back a couple of years. And really what inspired this program was another resilience program called Rockefeller 100 Resilient Cities. And this was a big global effort. It was $100 million. It was 100 global cities trying to get cities to appoint chief resilience officers at the mayoral level and in the executive office, really, to bring different programs, different resources to bear in a more holistic way. And we looked at that program and said, it's effective. It's something that we saw a lot of cities competing for. But what we wanted to do was take that value, that ethos, and bring it down to smaller or mid-sized cities. It was great that the Rockefeller program was helping LA and New York and London and Beijing. But what about cities that we've worked with, Tempe, Arizona, or Arcata, California, or Dubuque, Iowa, or for that matter, St. Louis Park, Minnesota?
Wait, did you say small to mid-sized cities in St. Louis Park, Minnesota?
I sure did.
Oh, wow. What a coincidence.
Yeah, we wanted to reach cities where they were. And I think something that gets lost a lot in the cities discussion, particularly in this country, is that there's a lot of cities and more Americans live in a municipality or a local government that is smaller than a population of 50,000 than larger. So most Americans live in what we would consider to be a small community, even if it's part of a major metropolitan area. The government that serves them, the people that they elect are volunteers for the most part. It's a different scale of government. So we wanted to lean into the strengths of the National League of Cities, which is the breadth of cities that we cover, and really try to meet an unmet need with this program. We work with between 7 and 10 cities each year. The number has fluctuated. For the last 2 years, we've done 8. That's really just dependent on time and resources and how the grant is structured. We take in applications on an annual basis, and we basically go through a checklist for strength of the application, but also national diversity, diversity of city size, diversity of city projects. We don't want to just do all energy projects or all water projects. And we look at where we feel like the National League of Cities is best positioned to help. We get a lot of great applications that are really tremendous and would really build local resilience. But if it's not something that we feel like we can help with within the time frame of a year, maybe we'll go back to that team and recommend that here's some other opportunities or here's some other resources that could meet your needs, but it's just not the best fit for our program. We give them the money and then we just scope out a project and we say, you know, if you're looking back at the end of this year, what would success look like for you? What do you hope to accomplish? And how can we identify some partners or just be a resource for you directly? And we've done that. And I've got a great team that leads all of these projects. It's certainly not just me doing all of this this work. That was the original goal of the program. And we've certainly worked over the years and learned a lot about what we can do. And now I think the next thing to your question earlier, the next thing we really want to do is help cities use the ARP dollars, the rescue plan dollars, and prepare for the infrastructure bill, because we really want to get out of an austerity mindset that we've been in, where, you know, local governments are strapped for resources, or they'd never really recovered from the Great Recession. Staff was never rehired. I think there's going to be tremendous opportunities for cities the next 4 or 5 years as these resources come from the federal government to staff up, to get a little bit more ambitious, to use these resources as wisely as possible, as effectively as possible, to not just serve residents or do basic maintenance, but to really rethink what it means to be a local government and to provide services to residents in a more robust way. And that's, I think, what we think of when we think of resilience, is it's not just about climate action, but it's about being a local service provider and making your community a more livable, more equitable, more attractive place to be.
In reading through some of the recipients last year and this year, there's a few that popped out that I'd love for you to talk about. You know, some of the things going on in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and maybe some of a couple of Iowa cities there, Cedar Rapids, Dubuque. What kind of things do cities do with this funding? What kind of projects?
Yeah, well, the specific ones you mentioned there, Portsmouth, Cedar Rapids, Dubuque, they're all currently in our program for 2021. So they haven't finished up yet. A lot of what we have done the last couple of years is helping cities maintain a focus on climate and not get too sidetracked by the pandemic. We know that we can have a greener, more equitable recovery from this if we put our minds to it. Portsmouth is interesting because it is a regional project. Portsmouth was the lead applicant, but we're working with a local community-based organization. We're working with a couple of other cities in the region. And what they had found was there was pretty good climate resilience, climate adaptation work going on in coastal New Hampshire. But they wanted to move a little bit further up the watershed into communities that weren't so existentially threatened by sea level rise. And that was really the driving force of all the coastal communities to get more involved and think more about climate change. But for cities that were a little bit further inland, it maybe wasn't as pressing of an issue. But they wanted to take a lot of the community engagement work, take a lot of the priorities that had come from coastal communities and use those to inform and speed up the learning curve of communities that were a little bit inland. That's been our priority. Flooding, of course, isn't just a coastal issue. It's been an issue ever since really Hurricane Irene went up into that region and flooded a lot of the streams and creeks and tributaries. Cedar Rapids and Dubuque are both really interesting communities for Iowa because they've been focused on climate action for a little while and because both are coming from different climate-related disasters. Cedar Rapids had the derecho a little bit more than a year ago, which took out more than 50% of their tree canopy. Their reason for re-elevating this during the pandemic was that they had just lost a whole lot of their stormwater management capacity. They just lost a whole lot of trees that made their neighborhoods beautiful and attractive and enjoyable places to be. Trees that kept the urban heat island down and kept things a little bit cooler over the summer. That had been their focus, and they actually had started a really interesting program called the Roll and Rec Mobile, which was essentially a mobile city hall. And it was really designed initially as a recreational opportunity. They wanted to get city services out into the community, attract kids to be more active. And they sort of looked at it and was like, huh, this is really working. It's engaging with residents that we haven't traditionally engaged with, who don't just show up to community meetings and participate all the time. What if we kitted this thing out with a few more resources and didn't make it just about athletic recreation? What if we provided disaster assistance services through this? And so after the derecho, they had done that. And it was, of course, really effective. And they wanted to double down and continue to add more features and more ways for the residents to engage with it. And so we've been supporting that effort for the last year to provide pandemic relief resources, but also derecho recovery resources out into different neighborhoods.
How many years have you been running this program? How many cohorts have you had?
We've had 5 cohorts in just over 5 years. Our first year was a pilot year, so we took a little bit more time than we otherwise would have.
Sure. And I imagine you kind of tweak it as you go along and as you're learning things. What are some of the best practices or lessons learned that have emerged from some of the past cohorts?
We've learned a lot of lessons, that's for sure. One lesson learned is the focus on regional governments, and it comes back to our focus on small to mid-sized cities as well. There is a tremendous potential for small cities to be leaders in their metropolitan areas. We saw this most dramatically probably in our Roland Park, Kansas project, which really was, again, a regional collaborative. We supported the creation of the Metro Kansas City Climate Action Coalition. And there it was Mayor Kelly in Roland Park and council member Lindsay Constance in a neighboring jurisdiction called Shawnee. And both were relatively small communities, but they raised their hands and made themselves the voluntary chairs of the Metro Climate Action Coalition, got the regional council involved, got more than 100 other local elected officials to come together, as well as county officials, as well as state officials in the Kansas side of the Metro Kansas City area. We just saw a lot of potential out of that. And it's one of the things that inspired us to bring Portsmouth as well as Arlington, Massachusetts in, which both of which are regional projects this year. Another lesson that I think we have learned is that it's really important for cities to embed resilience, climate action, sustainability, however you want to locally define and prioritize it, into the core functions of government. A lot of cities think they need to start with a climate action plan or a sustainability plan that's sort of separate from the rest of their planning processes. And I think in a lot of areas, that's a mistake because it doesn't get to the heart of how resources are allocated, how decisions are made, what rules govern neighborhood development, economic development, and all of the other things that you need to really start to touch and move and tweak in order to have more aggressive climate action. The last thing that we've learned that we'll be promoting whenever we do the next iteration of this is that focus on budgeting and resources. And I mentioned this earlier in the conversation. As cities get more resources, whether it's from ARPA or the infrastructure package or the reconciliation Build Back Better plan, we need them to use those funds as well as possible for climate action if we're going to have success. And then you also asked about lessons for cities. The last thing I would say is we know a lot and we've learned a lot, but there's still so much that's unknown. And I think sometimes cities get really hung up on the precision of data and, you know, exactly how bad is it going to be in our particular region. And I think sometimes that's a mistake, and focusing more on the positive values that you share as a community. What kind of community do we want to be? Do we want to be a Tree City USA or a Bike City USA, something along those lines that you can really make it about values that you share right now, about goals that you have in the next 2 to 4 or 5 years, as opposed to this looming climate thing that's, you know, setting goals for 2040 or 2050. I think that's something that we've been forced to do because we work with cities over the course of a year in our technical assistance, but it's definitely a lesson that I would encourage other cities to take up.
Yeah, I agree. We can be crippled by the minutia that is in data sometimes and not be able to move forward. You know, I think that it's still important to have ambitious goals, but how do you make them more tangible, or how do you make them more relatable to your day-to-day life and the quality of life within your community? What advice do you have? So cities that maybe they're just getting started, and I know you kind of laid some of that out there, but if they're just getting started, they want to strengthen their resilience or improve their sustainability, where do they start? What should they be looking to do?
Well, the good news is that we have been at this for quite a while. So if you're a city that is just getting started or trying something new that you haven't, you know, tried before regarding sustainability or climate action or climate resilience, the first thing you should definitely do is look and figure out who's tried it before. And there are a lot of networks. National League of Cities is certainly one of them, where you can identify local leaders who've had this experience, who've made maybe a few mistakes and can give you some guidance on how to avoid that. I think this goes a little bit counter to what I just said, but the first thing you need to do is set a goal. Join a coalition, make a positive statement towards climate action. And there's ways to do that. Cities Race to Zero is a big one that's being focused on right now with COP26 happening. The America is All In coalition is another great one to join up with. So make that positive vision, then get focused on something in the short term. And Cities Race to Zero has more than 36 short-term actions that you can commit to. And this is a coalition that sets 50% emissions reduction by 2030 at its goal. But then it says, okay, you know, that's your goal. How are you going to start this year? Which one of these or which handful of these 35 known best practices can you take on right now? And so I would encourage cities to do that. The next thing I would really encourage you to do, and I mentioned this before, is look at your core budget documents, your core city planning documents, and stop doing the things that are counterproductive. We always talk about city sustainability, climate action as this extra thing that you have to start doing. And there's a lot of development practices, there's a lot of capital improvement projects that maybe have been on the books for a long time, were very well suited to a different era, a different economic reality. And instead of adding a new program, figure out what you can maybe repurpose or what you don't need to do that then frees up resources in order to reinvest in something that's a little bit more timely and a little bit more relevant to this moment. Now it's been almost 2 years of a pandemic. As we see the urgency of the climate crisis taking shape every spring with floods, every summer with wildfires that are continuing to spread, there's a tremendous opportunity to just reconsider how we allocate our existing resources instead of thinking of climate action as something extra that you have to add into government.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really, really important message, especially as we're gearing up for the infrastructure bill as well. And are we going to pour a bunch of money into a bunch of hard surfaces, do the same thing, bigger, harder, move that water faster, and have more problems down the road? Or are we going to look for different ways where we can put some more resilience and sustainability measures into how we approach our capital projects and other city projects?
Yeah, Abby, I'm really glad you brought up the infrastructure bill as an example of that, because I think there's just going to be so much flexibility in how cities use those funds. And are we going to invest them in our existing communities, do the maintenance that's required, more complete streets that are suitable for not just cars, but also for bikes, also for transit, also for pedestrians? I think we can do a lot to use this opportunity to make our communities more attractive, more flexible. The alternative, which would be expanding out into greenfield areas, building new roads, new highways. We've done that for a long time. And I think this should be an opportunity that cities look to supplement their auto infrastructure with other modes of transportation.
We were talking before this interview about where this program goes, and you're thinking of becoming more prescriptive with all these things you've learned. I mean, you've had a really unique perspective to have seen so many of these projects over the past 5 years. It can be tough for government to stop doing things. Those kinds of examples for you to be able to highlight going forward, I think would be immensely valuable, especially in the context of the way you said it. Hey, here's a local government that stopped doing something or really changed it to infuse climate and sustainability in what they're already doing. Because I fully agree that the way this works is when climate becomes a lens with which we view everything that we do.
Yeah, and there are more and more examples of that happening. And I can highlight a couple very specifically. And this isn't credit to National League of Cities or anything. We didn't do this. But Pittsburgh just recently adopted what they're calling a climate budget. And they basically went through a priorities-based budgeting process that looked at line items of the budget a little bit differently and tried to align them not on what specific thing is this purchasing, you know, pens or supplies or whatever, but what goal is this helping us achieve? And they ended up basically identifying $40 million, about 5% of the budget, that they just figured wasn't really serving the community's mission, its values, its goals, its stated reason for being in the comprehensive plan. And they reallocated that as a climate budget. $40 million is now going towards climate-specific priorities and programs in Pittsburgh. Another good example is the city of Ann Arbor, Michigan, which put out a 2030 plan for a sustainable, equitable Ann Arbor. And again, identified not just annual budget opportunities, but capital investment opportunities in their capital improvement plan, in their bond initiatives, and where they needed to invest in order to achieve their goals in the next 9 years. And then I think another interesting example is in Minneapolis. And this is a classic example of perhaps not doing something the same way or repurposing things, is the Minneapolis upzoning, the elimination of single family zoning there, or other cities that have looked to eliminate parking minimums. This debate always gets framed in unfortunate ways. They're not saying every lot needs to be a duplex or a triplex or a quad. What they're saying is that every lot's eligible. And it's going to take us decades to make those kinds of transitions. There's no reason for it to be as a matter of law that every single unit in a city needs to have 1.8 parking spots, allowing a little bit more flexibility. Stop doing the thing that we've been doing, that we've been mandating for so long. I truly think that that's going to be one of the most impactful sustainability and climate action programs that we have. And it's never really discussed as a climate action program. It's just changing the rules a little bit to do something differently than we've done it in the past. And it also should be noted that that doesn't cost the city a whole lot.
Great examples. And we'll point out to those listening, if you want to hear more about Ann Arbor, we happened to interview Missy Stultz, the sustainability director from there, a few episodes ago.
If you're listening to me right now, do yourself a favor and stop this podcast and go listen to Missy. she is an incredibly dynamic leader there in Ann Arbor, a good friend of our program, and probably has some better recommendations, better advice, more eloquently stated than myself.
Well, Cooper, thank you so much for this. This has been really, really helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Cooper.
All right, Larry, what are your takeaways?
Yeah, you know, I was really impressed with the conversation. Sometimes with these kind of organizations, you think that it might be very high level stuff, but Cooper's had a really unique vantage point with this leadership program they've done over the past 5 years with smaller mid-sized cities on climate resilience stuff. And I think the insights he provides are really useful. And also, I'm really interested to see how they take the program forward and trying to be more prescriptive about what using what they've learned to help cities do things that have been proven to be effective.
I find myself going to the League's site more and more for some of these resources and helping cities out. So I think that they have been and are increasingly a tremendous asset on climate resilience mitigation tools for cities.
And his point really resonated with me around we need to rethink what local government does and what the abilities that it actually has and being a service provider and a catalyst in this realm. Mm-hmm. That resonated a lot with me.
Yeah. Going back, way back to the Albany episode, you know, if states are the laboratories, cities are the petri dishes, right? And so it's testing and seeing how things work and sharing those stories. And that's part of what we're doing here is trying to share those stories and provide the how-tos for other cities to pursue and be successful with some of these things. And it's a good time to be prepared. Last time around, coming out of the last recession, we talked about the ARRA funding coming through. And I don't know that local governments were super prepared and they were in kind of austerity mode. And here comes this money. And is it worth it to go after it and replacing boilers, doing envelope, those kinds of upgrades to their city operations or city buildings? And maybe some things that reached out into the community, but we've come such a long way since 2009 to 2013 in the sophistication and the urgency that we're seeing on the local level. And as these resources start to come from the federal government, we have the infrastructure bill now in place, and fingers crossed that Build Back Better makes it through, there's going to be another avalanche of resources coming towards cities, and National League really does a great job of breaking it down. And now you have all these examples of how to use it. In preparation for this money coming, cities should start thinking about, how do we want to use it? What are our big ticket items? How do we want to get this money out into the community?
Oh, yeah, that's a big topic in St. Louis Park. One other thing I'll mention, which seems to be coming up more in some of our episodes, is he talked about some of the successes they saw in regional collaboration. And our last episode with Aetna, that was a key theme. And I think we want to explore that maybe in following up on some of the cities that NLC is working with.
Yeah. So that's, Portsmouth, I think, was the coastal regional collaboration, and looking at what they're doing on some adaptation measures and just working together, talking together. Aetna is a good example. And hopefully funding reflects that. How do we help folks out regionally instead of just everybody for themselves? So that's a good point. And also reminds me that we should do a call for stories. I think that we got a lot of, you can just go through their list of cities that they've worked with and seen some stories there, but just want to throw it out there. If you're listening and you're like, my city is doing such a great thing, you guys should share it.
Send us an email. What's that email they should use?
I wasn't prepared for this. I think it's cityclimatecorner@gmail.com.
Oops, blooper. Send it to cityclimatecorner@gmail.com.
I got it right. There you go. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We hope you enjoyed this episode of City Climate Corner. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to subscribe and give us a review. If you're able, become a monthly supporter through Patreon. As always, you can find more information on this topic and resources from each episode's guests on our webpage, cityclimatecorner.com. If you have an idea for the show, send us an email at cityclimatecorner@gmail.com or find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
City Climate Corner is produced by Abby Finnis and me, Larry Kraft, edited by me. Our production assistant is Maggie Morin. Music by
King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.